WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I am Jason Mann, and today my guest for the very first time is Robert Newsom of the Professional Wrestling Tumblr. Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
Doing really well. So we are continuing the Starrcade's main event series with a Starrcade 1988 Ric Flair taking on Lex Luger. Ric Flair, of course, longtime champion, greatest wrestler of the 80s, just a tremendous icon. Luger, sort of the up-and-comer over the last couple of years. He'd been just a rookie in 86, but was kind of built up big in the wrestling magazines. And I kind of thought of this, I was more of a WWF fan than a NWA, WCW fan, didn't really watch that a whole lot, but I certainly paid attention to what was going on in the magazines, and I remember when the build-up during this match and when it was happening, I'm like, okay, they're going to make Luger into their Hulk Hogan, and, you know, have him win, have him overcome the obstacles, and then, you know, Luger's going to be the guy for, you know, the next few years, just because, like, my mentality was how WWF worked. And, of course, that didn't happen. You know, Flair retains here, and there's a lot of backstage stuff kind of involved in that, which we can get into. But so what, you know, you grew up much more of, you know, with the NWA side of things. You were kind of a loyalist on that side. You know, what were your thoughts on Flair and Luger at this point?
Well, I'll tell you, when you first asked me to do this, I was really excited about it. And then the email came that said it was the Flair Luger match. And I just could never get into Luger. I never understood the appeal of this guy. I mean, yeah, he looked great, but he just seemed like one of those guys that didn't have a firm footing and was trying to figure things out, I guess, too late. He was already thrust into the spotlight before he really had plotted a course, either he or, you know, whoever was helping him out along the way. And I know the history of, you know, who he trained with, and he had, I believe he and Hogan and Orndorff all had the same trainer, so there's, you know, a good background there. He came from a really good background in the what I call the fake sports, most people call the legitimate sports. So, you know, he has a good background, and on paper, this guy looks like he should be just an incredible, a sensational thing. And I think on analysis, and something I thought of while you were talking just now, is I think even when he was in NWA and WCW, Luger was a WWF style guy. And I think that's what turned me off, because you're absolutely right. I was a loyalist to the NWA, WCW stuff. But he seemed to be – I don't want to, you know, put thoughts in anybody else's head or second-guess booking that happened 30 years ago, but almost 30 years ago. But he seemed to be an attempt to – I don't want to use the word create, because I think that might be slightly offensive in this case, but for lack of a better term, to create someone who was going to come in and work and act and be in the WWF style, that bodybuilder physique, that limited moveset, and he just never seemed to fit in no matter where they put him. Does that answer your question, or did I go off on a track?
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, I think the thing with Luger is I think he was actually stronger as a heel. Like, I thought he clicked pretty well, and I think that had to do with sort of his aloofness and sort of his natural arrogance. And he'd actually made strides as a wrestler here, although he's still very raw. He actually kind of reminds me of early Cena. And just like, he's very powerful, he's very strong, the effort's there, but it's just sort of a matter of like the positioning is there, kind of the execution of the moves in a lot of terms is weak, and he's relying on Flair to make everything he does look good, which Flair does a remarkable job because it's Flair. But I agree. I hadn't really thought of that before, but I guess, you know, Luger in the style as well as in the image was definitely kind of more of a WWF guy. The WCW or NWA transitioning into WCW at this point, you know, the sale from Jim Crocker Promotions to Turner had happened after a couple of really strong years of business. They had really fallen off. They were the default number two because basically every other promotion had gone belly up or was about to go belly up. But they really were, you know, after at least being somewhat close in the national, you know, landscape, at least somewhat close to what WWF was doing, they'd really, you know, starting to fall behind, and it would get even worse in the early 90s. But, definitely Luger was not the answer. I mean, he looked the part, but he didn't have the charisma. He didn't have the natural, ability. Although, I do think that he did get smoother and improve in kind of 89 and 90, where he was doing some, you know, pretty good work and still putting forth the effort. And then at some point he just kind of stopped trying too much and only occasionally would kind of see glimpses of the old Luger throughout the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I don't know too much about his, I know, you know, he was the narcissist and things like that. And I know that, I mean, he got him over. He was still in the national spotlight. And then I should pull this up on the internet, but pretend I already know this and we're just doing it for the benefit of the listener. He was kind of redressed as a new Hogan in the WWF. Is that correct? Wasn't he the guy they put the red, white, and blue Zubaz on and
yeah.
made him
yeah.
the All-American, I think? And
yeah, they tried a huge thing with him in 93 where, you know, and really, you know, I mean, played at the patriotism thing, really tried to recreate Hogan, and it was a pretty big flop. I mean, it worked to a certain level, but it didn't get him to the point where it should have based on the effort they put into him. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't want to go from being, as you said, the rookie of the year in 86 to main eventing Starrcade 2 years later is for this time, for the mid to late 80s, a really fast ascension. Now, obviously, the system is a little different, and you only have WWF to deal with. But I think that was kind of a really quick rise.
But actually, you know, Crockett, they had a tendency to do that, and they did that with Nikita Koloff. They did that with Magnum TA. They did that with Sting. I mean, those guys were not around for very long before they were in main event programs. And I guess it was kind of like because of the talent pipeline, because you know WWF had, you know, access and control to so many guys that, you know, when they had someone who got hot, they had to, you know, they had to throw them up there maybe quicker than some of them were ready. And they had Flair to make it work. So, you know, none of these matches were, you know, bad. They were at least, you know, pretty good.
And I definitely have a little bit to say that once we get in the match, but I'll preface it, I guess, by saying that Flair made him look amazing.
Yeah.
In this match, and with the benefit of hindsight, and of course, you know, everybody being, as they say, smart to the business now, looking at this match, you can see things throughout the entire more than 30 minutes that Flair is doing to just make this guy look unstoppable.
Sure.
And it was at least from an in-ring perspective, and I know we'll talk about the backstage stuff, but from an in-ring perspective, it was incredibly generous of this guy who had, you know, five-time heavyweight champion to take this guy in hand. And you know, they say that Flair can have a good match with a broomstick, and Luger definitely, I don't want to say he looked like the broomstick throughout the entire match, but there were areas where Flair made him look amazing, and it's clear with hindsight that that's what was happening.
Absolutely, yeah. We'll get a little bit into the background and kind of the goings-on behind the scenes before we get into the match. This was the first Starrcade in December. The other ones had been Thanksgiving, but then WWF started Survivor Series, forcing the competition, and NWA had to move the show. We have Jim Ross and Bob Caudle as the announcers, which I always enjoyed that team. Bob Caudle, sort of underrated historically. I really think that his commentary, whenever I've heard it, is always pretty spot on and excellent. He kind of has just like a, I don't know, like a trustworthy grandfather thing going on, which I always enjoyed.
I watched Smoky Mountain in the early 90s just for Bob Caudle. Bob Caudle and Gordon Solie, I mean, those voices are wrestling to me just because of, you know, what I grew up watching. And I mean, when I hear, I could hear him say one word and it's a flood of old man nostalgia that just washes over me because of his voice being so strongly tied to a lot of things that I enjoyed, a lot of events that I enjoyed as a kid. But yeah, the announce team on this was absolutely great.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things that's a big deal here is that Flair loses the title if he gets disqualified, which of course is playing off of the years and years of like screwy finishes that, you know, Crockett would do of Flair, you know, basically, you know, getting by the skin of his teeth, either by throwing somebody off the top rope or getting thrown over the top rope, or a lot of the cheap finishes that honestly had, you know, really hurt them in the long term because people just got sick of seeing that. But I thought it was funny that, you know, they made such a big deal about it here. Like, okay, no, you know, he can't do that anymore. We're finally going to give you like a good, clean, happy finish. And they, I guess they, I mean, it's relatively clean, but it's of course not what, you know, you would, it didn't send the fans home happy exactly.
No, it didn't. But I tell you, the finish of this match, and I know we haven't even started talking about it, but the finish of this match is actually and I watched this match several times because, as I said, I was not happy that it was a Luger match. But I really, I mean, I'm not going to change my opinion on the entire body of work, but this match, there is a flow to this match and a sense of storytelling to this match, and the way it finishes perfectly resolves the way it has been set up. And it's actually really well constructed event.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that when we get to the finish.
Sure. Sure. And just a little bit more into the upheaval in 88, you know, you had, Dusty Rhodes, who had been there, was, left at kind of, the story as I understand it is that basically Dusty Rhodes wanted, He and Flair were at odds. He wanted to book Rick Steiner to face Flair here and like beat him like,
yeah,
in 5
I heard
minutes.
That as well.
I guess the idea that Steiner, being a legitimate tough guy, would just beat up Flair, and Flair couldn't do anything about it. And of course, Rick Steiner was at the time kind of like a Eugene-esque character. I mean, a little, you know, not like literally, they didn't really literally have him be mentally disabled, but it was basically kind of the same thing. He was the, you know, idiot savant, so to speak. So
well,
that would,
yeah.
Yeah.
He took care of that perception on his own, I think.
Perhaps, but actually, I really enjoyed the Rick Steiner, that whole Rick Steiner storyline that they had with him and, you know, being taken advantage of by the Varsity Club, and then him finally beating Mike Rotunda was kind of a cool thing. But
I like the Steiners in spite of the Steiners, I think.
Okay.
But you know, there's a level of ridiculousness that. And sometimes you think that, you know, if Rick Steiner was, God forbid, standing in the room in front of me, what would his reaction be to hearing me say, I thought those guys were a lot of fun? Because obviously, you know, everybody involved with this is a carny on some level. And at the heart of this is people pay money to have fun. But if they hear you say that, you know, if there's this big Papa Pump, you know, tough guy, you know, and hearing you say, oh yeah, it was a lot of fun, it just seems at odds, I guess, with the image. But
okay, that's interesting.
Anyway,
yeah. I guess it's sort of maybe like an old school mentality and kind of the mentality of tough guys, like, you know, yeah, we're, you know, still, you're right, like the old school carny, you know, tough guy, like, oh, we're, you know, even if they're willing to acknowledge that it's not real, and most of them are, obviously, but they still are like, well, we could still win in a real fight kind of thing, you know?
Right.
Like, we're still tough guys. We're still, you
right.
know, yeah.
Oh, we'll still beat you down, but.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, Yeah, so they were kind of transitioning to a new regime. I don't know if you're familiar with Larry Matisic, and he did a bunch of he's the was booker and announcer in St. Louis for many, many years. He's done a lot of interviews and on various shows, and he was talking about I guess there was a movement to bring him in for a while and kind of being one of the people, one of the bookers or whatever, and his. The original plan of this was actually for Flair to win this. Once they got Dusty out, the original plan for this was to have Flair win this clean and then kind of move, kind of rebuild Flair in a sense, make him like the, instead of being like the guy who gets by the skin of his teeth, kind of restore his credibility a little bit as the guy who is just better than everyone kind of thing. So, which kind of led into 89 a little bit because obviously 89, it's, he eventually transitions into being a good guy, and he and Steamboat have that great rivalry, and those are clean finishes, and he's able to beat Terry Funk. I mean, it's not Flair, it's not the same Flair in '89, which I think was a mixture. I mean, obviously the matches in '89 were brilliant, but it wasn't really successful, and it did take away a little bit of the color from Flair to a certain extent.
I think you're right, but I think Flair in the South, at least around the people that I knew in Georgia, and I had family in North Carolina, and obviously North Carolina is a whole different story because he became the hometown hero. But it almost seemed that no matter what he was doing on television, no matter what rules he was breaking or rules he was following, if he was a fan favorite or a rule breaker, as they were called then, it just didn't matter. This guy was over to an extent that, that's just Ric Flair. And there are other wrestlers that you turn on or are in favor of based on their in-ring behavior. But I mean, I really just think that was all secondary to the persona that Ric Flair being Ric Flair. I don't want to make it sound too metaphysical, but I think in some ways he transcended all of the good or bad or the standard kind of trappings of sides or behaviors. He was Ric Flair, which was a thing unto itself.
Sure. Yeah, and then that like totally adult Jason gets that, like 32-year-old Jason gets that, but 9-year-old Jason at this point thought like Ric Flair was like the least cool thing ever, and that Ric Flair was like just like was like, why is this guy, the champion, and why is he the big deal? And I don't understand it. I guess there was just something that, I don't, I can't explain that entirely, other than maybe just the way that Ric Flair was portrayed and my perception of wrestling was like, and it was obviously a very WWF centric, view of wrestling, because that's, that was what I was exposed to. That's what I knew. That's what I understood. And nothing else was going to click. So, and then of course years later I discovered the brilliance of Flair and understood and got into it and appreciate all of his various forms, even the later maybe embarrassing stuff. But yeah, it's just sort of weird how Flair was there was something about Flair at that point to me where I just could not access it at all. Maybe I was just too young, I don't know.
I understand. And honestly, I think it may say some things about my personality that I might not want said, that when I saw the Horseman follow Dusty Rhodes and beat him with a baseball bat in a parking lot on television, I knew then it doesn't matter what these guys do. They are the real deal, and I want to be on their side. Whether it was through fear, because at the time there was still a very real possibility that these guys were going to come over to my house and kick me in the face for some reason. I don't know, real or imagined. I just, for some reason, Ric Flair, you almost wanted that, whether it's from a materialistic point of view of, okay, he's always got the expensive clothes and airplanes and watches and whatever, those trappings, or whether it's just the, no one can mess with this guy. And when you are, a quiet, reserved, nerdy 9, 10, 11-year-old kid, and you see this guy that literally no one can or wants to mess with, there's something really appealing about that, regardless of how closely he's adhering to the don't throw the guy over the top rope rule.
Sure.
I know I'm getting too psychoanalytical about grown men pretending to beat each other up, but at the same time, I mean, that's I think part of the joy in exercises like the one that we're engaged in right now is that almost overanalyzing of these things to this extent.
Yeah, we encourage overanalyzing things here. We're very big fans of it. So keep on doing it. I'm enjoying it. But so we basically set up where Luger's been. Flair, you know, is Flair. He's been champion most of the last 5-6 years. Main event at every Starrcade. Come out with the title in every Starrcade at the end. So he's Mr. Starrcade, in fact, as Tony Schiavone refers to him.
Right. Baseball has its Mr. October, and I guess we'd have to call Flair Mr. Starrcade.
Indeed.
Good job, Tony. Good job. I wrote that one down, too. Oh, God. Tony Schiavone.
Hey, Tony was pretty good at this point.
I will say this. If you're watching old wrestling and Tony Schiavone has a mustache, you are watching a good wrestling program.
I would agree with that. Yes. I think that's a very good analysis. Spot on there.
Now, he has a goatee now, which is questionable. But
right.
He's still in Georgia, and he's working for the Atlanta Braves. And so he's still in the media here with his goatee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't like that with Tony.
I lived in Atlanta for a few years, so I remember hearing him on WSB radio. You know, every once in a while, I was like, oh, mm-hmm. Tony Schiavone, nice. So, good for Tony. Let's see. So, but Flair is now without the Horsemen because Arn and Tully have left. So Wyndham's still around. I mean, I guess they're officially still the Horsemen. And I know they kind of did a thing with Hiro Matsuda and JTEX Corporation. I guess that was a little bit after this. But so I guess they're still nominally around. But basically, you know, Arn's not around. You can't have the Horsemen without Arn.
And J.J. Dillon is referred to, I think it's telling, as the executive director of the Horsemen.
Ah, okay.
It's becoming a corporate entity, which I guess in 1988 was a thing to do. I mean, you had Alexander York, that's the name I'm looking for. You know, you had people like that coming into the mix, and that this corporate, American Psycho, Bret Easton Ellis thing was starting to worm its way even into professional wrestling. And so I think that executive director thing was kind of a fake in that direction. You know, the Horsemen are still a thing, guys, but there might not be four of them right now.
Okay. All right.
Or some of those four may be board members. I don't know. I'm sure. Again, reading too much into it, but that's what it seemed.
That makes sense. That's good. So we've got Flair. He's in green trunks and gold boots. Luger is in red trunks and white boots.
And I will say that that Flair is wearing the belt. And I don't know if you've read Heenan's book, but Heenan says specifically in his book, and something that I 100% agree with, is he has no patience for a champion who does not wear the belt.
You don't throw it over
your shoulder. You don't carry it to the ring. I don't really follow what WWF is doing right now, but I did try to watch Raw for a while. And I noticed that that Cody Rhodes is wearing the belt under the suit, and that's coming back, and I'm fully behind that.
Mm-hmm. I do enjoy wearing the. I like wearing the belt too. There may be some characters where you don't have them wear the belt. Maybe Austin. Like, I'm not sure wearing the belt was right for Austin. I don't think he really ever did that.
It worked for Austin, I think. It worked for the NWO because of what they were. It strangely worked for Taz, I think. I can't really see. And he did wear the belt.
But yeah, I recall Taz wearing the belt mostly.
When he came out with it over his shoulder, for some reason that worked better.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, wear the belt, guys.
For the most part, I agree. Wear the belt. Yes. It's better. So the first half of this match, it sort of all builds to it builds. Luger controls a lot of it, probably like 70% of it. And it kind of builds to a big thing with looks like Luger's going to win, and then suddenly Flair is able to injure Luger's knee, and which we'll get into the details of later. And then Luger, and then the rest of it is Luger trying to struggle to overcome the knee injury and still beat Flair. So I think that's really the structure of it is really good. The length of it is pretty unusual. You know, longer than most main event matches would be today.
And I thought it was interesting that they did establish a time limit of 45 minutes for this.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had Gary Capetta calling out 5-minute intervals.
Yeah. Which I like. I always enjoy the time calls. I get why they don't. I mean, I understand why WWE doesn't like to do that because of the whole we're not a sport thing.
Right.
We don't want anything that reminds us of, you know, of sporting stuff. But yeah, I do think there is some, the time calls do add a sense of drama, especially as it gets close and, you know, so forth. So, but basically, you know, we've got Flair kind of working the mind games, taunting Luger. I like that he slaps fives, with JJ Dillon.
I wrote that down too. I think that was a great moment there when
yes.
he did that.
Yeah. And eventually he gets cocky after Luger misses a clothesline, and then he gets sent over the top by Luger. Luger flexes as he is wont to do. Lex Luger enjoys flexing very much, I've noticed.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one later in the match that I want to spend a little time on, so I'm gonna let this first flex go.
Okay. All right. Very good. We notice Lou Thesz in the crowd at this point, so good old Lou. Nice to see him there.
Right.
And then we have Luger shoulder blocking Flair, who cowers in the corner, calls timeout, establishing a bit of a slow pace. Luger wants to test his strength, but Flair sneaks in with a shot, then comes off the rope, but runs right into Luger with a nice little leapfrog and not really little given Luger, and a power slam, following with a press slam. And Flair, of course, at this point is in utter agony, screaming and yelling about, you know, his back is shot. He's near death. You know, it's
and what's Luger doing while this is happening?
He's
flexing.
Yes.
Yes. And now before all of this, right at the very first time, and you mentioned earlier about this notice qualification rule, I think this comes into play here. It's early in the match, but, you know, Luger had shot Flair into the ropes. Flair stopped the momentum by grabbing the rope. There's a little more taunting and flexing by both of them. And then Luger clotheslines Flair over the top rope, and Luger is now on his knees flexing in the ring. This is when Flair staggers around outside and talks to Dillon and then walks up the aisle toward the locker room. Mm-hmm. And a lot is made of this because it looks like here that and I was unclear on this because the stipulation was the disqualification would cause it to change hands, but nobody said anything about a count out.
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if this wasn't a little bit of psychology kind of playing with that expectation, because Flair's been known to take long rests outside the ring.
Sure.
But this one, he's walking, I mean, he's making a beeline for the locker room door. And then almost as if he had a second thought about it, he kind of turns on his heel and comes back to the ring there. So there's a nice little bit of psychology as he's clotheslined over the top, where he basically plays with the idea of not needing to deal with this trouble and giving up on it altogether.
Yes, very good point. Now we kind of move into my favorite part of what Luger does in this match is starting to work the arm. Like he sends a Flair arm first into the corner several times, sends him in the turnbuckle. Then he works his other arm on the ground, and they don't mention this, but I kind of think of this as like with Luger having his year or so with the Horsemen and the stuff, you know, with, of course, the Andersons being known for working the arm, you know, for all their stuff. I just kind of think of like, okay, Luger learned all this from Arn and Flair during his year in the Horsemen and kind of incorporating that into, it's only a brief section of the match, but I'm just thinking like, oh yeah, okay, I could see this being part of that story.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right on that, because obviously if he's spending time in this stable, and there's no pun intended by that, he's going to learn the ways of these guys. And I hadn't really thought of that, but you're absolutely right. I think that the attention paid to that arm is definitely at least a callback, whether it's intentional or not, to that style.
Sure, definitely. And So Luger's, you know, he's doing well here. Gets a hip toss, then kind of gets a reprieve with a Flair gets reprieve with a thumb to the eye. But then, you know, we work some chops in the corner, and then Luger shows fire right away and challenges Flair to do it more. Again, with the whole Luger, I think like four times in this match, shrugging off the Flair chops, which, go ahead.
And that, well, that look in the corner, the camera tight shot of Luger's face, and he looks like Ultimate Warrior there. The expression and the way his body is moving is very warrior-esque, if I can say that. And when Flair thumbs him in the eye, I had to write this down because this is amazing. Bob Caudle says, and this is a direct quote, "It doesn't make a difference how big you are, how strong you are, what kind of muscles you've got. A finger to the eye, that'll stop them all."
Oh, Bob Caudle.
So well put.
Yes.
Good job, Bob.
Yeah, excellent, Bob. So, you know, we get to the point of they go outside, and then Luger works Flair's arm more, you know, on the rail, sending him into the ring post. Then he works an armbar for a while. So more of that. Then finally, about 10 minutes in, we get our first near fall with running of the ropes. Then Luger misses one clothesline, but then gets a big one for the second. Then follows with a big suplex and then a jumping elbow drop misses. So then finally, we kind of get Flair doing a bit of work here, tossing Luger out of the ring, slamming his head on the rail, working him over. Then Flair goes back in and argues with Tommy Young a bit. And
it's important to the first time that first two count, when the cover's near the ropes and Flair is standing on the apron and Luger picks him up for the vertical suplex, bringing him back into the ring. While that is going on, you see the first thing that becomes a little significant later. J.J. Dillon is distracting Tommy Young while that's going on.
Okay.
And that comes into play later. And then, but as you said, when Flair comes back into the ring and there's that altercation with Young, bad camera work on that too, by the way, because the camera stays on Luger. The first time the camera cuts to this argument between Flair and Tommy Young, you see Tommy Young push Flair, Flair pushes him back, then Tommy Young pushes Flair again and sort of points to his shirt to kind of remind him, you know, "I'm wearing the stripy shirt here. You guys keep it in the ring."
Yes. Yes. I bet that's exactly how he said it too.
Yeah. I think the word stripy was definitely thrown around.
I hope so. I hope so. Flair working him over with a knee drop, snapmare, and a double stomp, which I don't recall ever seeing Flair ever do before.
No, I noted that as well. That was, man.
Yes.
That's gotta hurt.
Yes, it does. So chops and elbows into the corner, and Luger stumbles for a while, but then eventually does the no sell, and we get the peck dance this time.
That's exactly the flex I wanted to talk about, and I don't know what it's called, but my exact notes say Luger does that weird peck flexing thing where your boobs bounce around. It looks kind of gross.
It does.
And it really is disgusting.
Yes.
And guys, I don't know who listens to this or what your pecs look like. Never do that.
Yeah.
Just can we just never do that?
Yeah.
Because it's just, there's no place in society for that.
I guess Chris Masters was the last one to do that in wrestling that I can recall. So he didn't have a job anymore. So,
and that's why.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and he was even a pretty good worker too.
But it was the boob dance.
Yes.
Sorry, man.
Yeah. Long term, the boob dance is never going to help you out.
No tolerance.
No. Fair enough. So then Luger works a sleeper for a little bit, and Flair eventually goes down to one knee, but he gets back up and hits a back suplex. We get a kind of a big series of near falls with Flair trying the figure four, but Luger getting the inside cradle for two. Then Flair gets him back in control for a bit, goes to the top, which leads to a Luger superplex for two, which fans were into that near fall. Thought that actually might be it, which is kind of cool to see on a superplex. I take this moment to say that the fans were invested in this whole thing. In fact, this whole show, the fans are just insane. I or I was going to say Baltimore, but Baltimore was Great American Bash. I don't remember the city off the top of my head.
This is Virginia. This is from Norfolk, Virginia.
That's right. Yeah.
You can tell because when there's the 10 punches in the corner, the crowd has a very thick Virginia accent. The last two numbers are 9 and 10. And Jim Ross actually, he makes a note of this when Luger applies the figure four onto Flair. Jim Ross says, this is an NWA wrestling crowd here. They love this physical combat. And it's that subtle thing. A lot of people think that, you know, this started with Bischoff and Nitro, but there were digs being taken at the competition, the nameless competition, all through this event. And even in this, you know, Jim Ross was clearly stating, this is an NWA crowd. This is what the NWA crowd is into.
Yeah.
These other guys, you know, with their rock and wrestling connection, who knows what they like. Jim Ross also said, I'll tell you what, Bob, if wrestling could be considered an art form, that man, referring to Flair, is using oils and a million others are using watercolors.
I missed that, but wow.
I don't know what that means. Apparently, Jim Ross does not consider watercolor a legitimate medium. And one more thing about the crowd. There's a guy in – I guess he's about the fifth row back who is absolutely losing his mind during this match. He's a guy – I think he has a beard. He's kind of a larger guy. He's going nuts through this entire thing. If you can pull this up on YouTube, it's the hard camera, not the handheld cameras. And when they cut to that angle, there's a guy about five rows back on the floor that's just going nuts during this match. And he alone is worth rewatching the match for. Anyway, let's get back to the action in the ring.
Sure. After that, Luger gets the figure four. Flair desperately tries to get out of it, and then Flair reaches for the rope, but Tommy Young keeps preventing him from doing that, which is strange because you're accustomed to the idea of, okay, once a guy touches the rope, you have to break. Right. But my understanding of how this works, and I think I read it like Scott Keith or I don't know, but the idea is that in the old days of wrestling, the ropes were out of bounds. So you're not allowed to use the ropes as leverage to pull yourself toward them to get tangled into the ropes.
Oh. See, I was wondering why that happened.
Right.
And I didn't know if they were setting something up with Tommy Young, and I had no idea. Because Tommy Young was the referee in Baltimore when the match was stopped for, quote, excessive bleeding by sure. the Maryland State Athletic Commission. It was the same referee there, the same three people in the ring. And so I didn't know if there was some, you know, I'm going to make sure, because much was made at the beginning of the match of the fact that this was Tommy Young in the ring and this man is going to call this exactly down the middle. And so to see, you know, him shoving Flair and pointing at his stripy shirt and kicking the rope out of his hands, it was a little confusing to me, and I'm glad you cleared that up.
Yeah, I think that's just, you know, the stuff with Tommy Young and Flair was just kind of the stuff they did in most matches. I mean, they you know, there was kind of the back and forth, because Tommy Young main event or referee pretty much every Flair or major Flair match, so, you know, they kind of had that going here and there. That sort of reminds me that we didn't really get into kind of the Luger Flair story at all. I mean, it's pretty simple. Basically, Luger replaced Ole Anderson in the Horsemen in early 87 and was with them for about a year. Then in early 8, he started being interested in challenging Flair. Horsemen didn't like that. He got turfed in favor of Barry Windham. Actually, he and Windham were a tag team very briefly and were tag champions, but then Windham turned on him in the title match to allow Blanchard and Anderson to win it back, and then Windham joined the Horsemen.
Was a great match, by the way.
Yes. And so Luger got his first shot at Great American Bash in the summer of 88 and was winning the match, had Flair up in the torture rack, but he had bled a little bit. It was very, very little blood, and Tommy Young, as you mentioned, stopped the match because of the blood, with the idea that the Maryland State Athletic Commission wouldn't allow it to continue, even though plenty of matches had occurred in Maryland where there was more blood. It was just like one of those like really bad.
But how could both of these men look okay at the end of this match?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, if Luger had been bleeding a whole lot, then the finish might have worked. But you know, because of the lack of blood, finish was awful. And even, you know, contradicted previous things, which, you know, is always one of those annoying things.
And not to give too much away about what we're talking about here, but no blood at all in this match.
Yeah.
And you're talking about Ric Flair at Starrcade, and nobody gets cut.
Well, my thought is that, you know, because the Crockett sale had happened late in 88, I think October or even November-ish. And so Turner's is over, and I think the blood at that point pretty much goes away because it's against Turner standards and practice. Also, there was the thing with Dusty Rhodes when he was fired. The reason he was – I think the official reason he was fired is because he did a big blood thing with the Road Warriors. You know.
And it's interesting to note that later in 95, his son would go out the same way from the first Uncensored.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Father, like son. I don't know if Cody is bleeding regularly, but and if you look at Flair's hands, he's got the finger tape on there, which is a good place to. And I shouldn't know this, and I apologize because I think that too many people being too smart can be detrimental. But the blade tape on the end of the fingers is present, so you didn't really know if you were going to see that or not.
Yeah, Cody actually did a few months ago. He got busted hard way on SmackDown. Orton nailed him with I think the ring bell, and he bled like crazy amount. They edited it out so you didn't really see it, but it was very, very brutal. So he didn't get fired for it because it wasn't his fault, but.
Well, obviously, fun gentleman fact. Hit with a ring bell.
Yes, exactly. So,
what a legacy the Rhodes family has established.
Yes, yes. So, back to the match after a little delay. So, more near falls with. Eventually Flair does get to the ropes. So, and then we do get a few more near falls with. Although Luger. Hits an inverted elbow to Tommy Young, who gets knocked outside. Luger goes to the top and gets the body press. Young is slow to get up, and it's only a two. Luger follows with a backslide for two. Gets the 10 punches with the heavy accent at the end from the crowd. Mm-hmm. And Flair does the half flip. And then we get a suplex off the apron for two. So a lot of near falls here, a lot of crowds into the drama. You know, we're getting to the point, like, it looks like Luger might be having this, you know. Luger poses again and shrugs off some more chops. But at this point,
does he flex?
At this point in the match, at least kind of that makes a little more sense because you can tell he's amped, he's pumped up. You know, Flair really hasn't been getting the advantage, so it's not kind of out of nowhere as much.
Right.
And Flair begs off. Luger gets a press power slam, and he signals for the rack. And then we get the J.J. Dillon up on the apron. Luger grabs him, a really good distraction, and then Flair nails Luger in the knee with a chair.
Right.
A friend of mine who watched this noticed it, is that after this happens, like, you can see somebody in the crowd who is really animated. Maybe you're a guy, I'm not sure, but he is like pointing to the ref and like trying to like tell the ref, hey, he hit him with the chair. Like, it's like the active participation of the crowd to like.
I think it might be that guy. I have a few notes about that guy.
Okay.
I've put little asterisks, and it actually says asterisk that guy, like, okay, throughout the match when he's going crazy. And I do have a that guy here, but
okay.
I don't know why that guy intrigues me so much, but well, there it is.
There you go, that guy.
And Ross said, as Ross says, the referee was in the back 40 using his Oklahoma farming roots there and didn't see what was going on. And, you know, Dillon at this point is you know, Luger had him by the lapels of his probably very expensive suit. And,
sure.
You know, he dropped Dillon, and Luger stayed in the ring. Flair's on the floor, reached into the ring, grabbed his ankles, dropped him to his back, pulled Luger out. And the whole time, Dillon is distracting the referee. Now, we don't know this through any other means by the fact, except for the fact that Ross and Caudle tell us, because again, you can't see this with the camera. And I know, you know, in 1988, handheld camera and production trucks, it was not as technologically advanced as you had even 10 years later, yeah. even 5 years later.
Sure.
But at the same time, that important part of the match was gone unseen. And that's why it's good to have somebody like Jim Ross or Bob Caudle doing the commentary, because they can paint that picture for you, probably using oils and not watercolors.
Exactly. Well, you know, this I believe this was Turner's first time doing WCW show. So maybe, you know, they were getting used to it, too.
It's possible. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, and my understanding is that Turner tended to use their like third-rate camera crews for the WCW stuff. So it may not have been their best people anyway.
Well, all I do know is that that when Luger gets hit, when he takes that chair to the knee, it's the first time in the whole match that he acts like something hurt him. and it's almost as if, you know, they I don't know that this happened, but before the match they're like, all right, you're gonna get this chair shot and it's gotta hurt.
Okay.
And so this is the first time in the match where he reacts as a normal human would react to these things that are happening to him.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it really shows that vulnerability, which it's kind of effective to, you know, it was about 25 minutes into the match where like, okay, now this guy who's been a Superman this entire time is now, you know, he's hit his kryptonite, for lack of a better term, you know? I mean, he kind of makes it even more like much like, oh my, you know, because we've seen all this stuff that doesn't hurt him. This hurt him. Now he's vulnerable kind of thing. I don't know if like, that was the idea, if that's just kind of the way it worked out, but it actually kind of in a way it works.
Well, it builds the tension in the match too, to see Luger, you know, staggering around and pulling himself up by the ropes and, you know, trying to stand and being unable to do it. And then Flair just continuing to, you know, drops to his knees and an elbow to the injured knee. And, you know, even the referee is trying to hold him back as Luger tries to stand and collapses in the corner. And then so there's a lot of tension being built up around that one sudden and very violent injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we basically have 5 minutes here of, you know, Flair dominating, working he works the figure four for a while. The Luger's able to turn it over, but, you know, he can barely stand. You know, some knee drops on the knee. Flair does go to the top and Luger does slam him down, but Luger's really unable to take advantage of it, kind of stumbles around. Flair does toss him out, though he does pop back in, but then
he immediately, it's almost like he forgot that his knee was hurt.
I get the sense that was more like an intentional, like, you know, like I'm, you know, just kind of bouncing. I mean, not wasn't in like an intentional lack of selling. It was more of like a...
Well, the announce team noted at that point, too, that he's just running on adrenaline.
Sure, exactly.
Immediately after he got thrown out and Luger jumps back onto the apron, this was an amazing move, and it happened super fast. And I don't even know if there's a name for this move, but Flair's waiting by the ropes, and Luger's on the apron. Mm-hmm. He grabs Luger's head and kind of uses the ropes to almost slingshot himself. He snaps down with a blow right across the back of Luger's head. And it happens super fast.
Yes.
And Luger just shakes the blow off. That move is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was executed, I don't think I've ever seen Flair do that before or since. But that one little piece that was done there, even though it wasn't sold and it was shaken off and really wasn't even announced that well, it was a really amazing move.
It was pretty Flair cool. Yeah, absolutely. Then we have Luger gets the press slam, but he stumbles. Flair tosses him through the ropes, though he does pop right back in and gets a sunset flip for two. Then Flair tries a big forearm, although he ends up sort of falling down. Luger mm-hmm. starts to get some energy back, though he is limping slightly, but he gets the 10 punches again right at 30 minutes. Gets a clothesline out of the corner, but only gets two, and as announcers point out, he did not hook the leg.
No. They did not grapevine that leg.
Nope, you got to do that. You got to grapevine the leg.
Always hook the leg.
I love how the terminology, like, in, you know, with the NWA and, like, and WWE was just a little bit different. Like, it was, you know, kind of like how they talk about Pulp Fiction, where, you know, everything's a little bit different in Europe, you know, Royale with cheese, right, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, clothesline versus lariat kind of thing.
Sure, sure. And
depending on who's doing it, it's either a clothesline. If they're from Texas, it's obviously a lariat. But it's the same with, yeah, the slight differences there. It is interesting, and I wonder if some nerd with too much time on his hands hasn't sort of collated these and made a handy chart that's on the internet somewhere.
That would be a wonderful thing. So if that has not happened, then somebody who's listening to this should do that, because
make
that
it happen,
would
be a
wonderful nerdy thing to do. Yeah, I feel I feel like I have a little bit of pull among the wrestling community. I think I could probably convince somebody nerdy enough to do that if they.
We need to make this happen.
We do need to make this happen.
Was it you that ranked all of the Survivor Series teams?
Yes, it was me.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, if we can make that happen, we can get this chart on the internet.
I agree. So we're getting close to the end here. We've got the Luger gets a power slam. He walks around the ring trying to pump himself up a little more. Limping.
Flexes.
Yeah, I believe there was a flex, yes. Did you count the flexes?
I did not. I could. I'll send you an email.
Okay, all right.
We'll let you know.
Yeah. So he lifts him up, gets in the torture rack, gets him up for a few seconds, but then his leg buckles, Flair falls right on top of him, and Tommy Young is in really good position here, because he sort of like slides in a position where he can see everything except for Flair shuffling around and getting his feet on the ropes.
Right, and to break out of the, you know, to pull back the curtain a little bit, that is ridiculously difficult, because even though these three men know the finish, and guys, I hope I'm not spoiling anything for your listeners, they did know the finish, he didn't know where it was going to happen or how it was going to happen. And for him to have positioned, and I did make a note of that too, for him to have positioned himself so well and so quickly to not see what he, to make this story work, had to not see, if that sentence makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
Was a really quick piece of thinking, and really shows the experience and value of somebody like that in the ring officiating this.
Yeah. And in my understanding is from what I mentioned before, Larry Matisic's interviews, is that Flair improvised the finish here, where it was supposed to be Flair winning clean, but Flair improvised putting the feet on the rope. So I don't know if Tommy Young knew it was coming or not. I mean, if he didn't know it was coming, it's even more brilliant. Even if he did, it's still a, you know, very impressive set of timing. And then after the finish, we kind of have Flair. Luger gets up. He's still limping. He complains about the ropes a little bit, kind of to the point where it almost comes off as a little bit crybaby-ish, although, you know, you kind of got to give him the circumstances a little bit. Although,
and Dylan comes in and argues, you know, on Flair's behalf, too. So there's a little bit of back and forth.
Sure. Sure.
And the cover that Flair won it with, by the way, I will note, is the only time Flair covered Luger in the whole match.
I didn't realize that, but wow, yes. that's pretty.
Flair never covered Luger once in this match until he was literally dropped on top of Luger coming out of that torture rack.
Well, good observation. I did not notice that. That's good stuff. So we end with Flair lying on his back on the mat with JJ holding the belt and raising his hand. Again, maybe an image that they did a little too often with Flair. I mean, Flair was so good at that, but at the same time, like, I do maybe think, like, on a national level, Flair was hurt, you know, perception-wise by doing that. And, you know, there have been others who have made that argument as well, which maybe is why Flair, you know, the NWA didn't do as well as WWF in the 80s, because, you know, it was sort of Flair was always putting other people over and not often enough, maybe, you know, winning in a credible fashion back when that was really a very important thing.
Right. And if there's one thing that we know about the WWF, it's that they do not like repetition with their high-level athletes.
Yes, exactly. one thing I really liked, particularly Caudle at the end, is trying to put over how close Luger came and how young he is. Like, you know, the kid's got a bright future. He's going to be back. It's going to be okay. Like, it was.
Yeah, he's going to get through this.
Yeah, it was a nice thing of, like, you know, protecting him in a sense of, like, you know, because, I mean, he obviously they booked him to lose a really, really big important match. So they did a nice job of, you know, couching that a bit.
Yeah, I think so. And then, obviously, you know, Luger had a future in the NWA. I mean, he went on to get the heavyweight championship. And I don't know if you were going to mention this, but in the in the interview after the match, Flair, you know, is standing in the locker room and he says, "I hope you enjoyed your chance to wrestle me for the title, because that's it. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do it again." And I believe he didn't. Is that right? I mean, that held true.
Did he ever wrestle? He did 1990. He did, but it was through 89. He did not. I mean, it was more than a year before he did get another shot at the title. So, you know, essentially it was true.
And when was that? Was that at Starcade 90? Is that?
No, it was, it was Wrestle War. It was.
Okay.
I think it was Wrestle. Right. I think it was February, because it was originally going to be Sting, and the Sting got hurt, so they turned Luger, and he got the shot instead. It was actually a really good match. Even I think maybe even a little better than this one, or at least on the same level as this one.
Was that about the time that he was? And I'm sitting in front of the internet, but was that at his feud with Dan Spivey at the time?
Was
that going on at the time too?
I think that was later, because that was around 90, because that was after he turned, because he was a good guy when he and Spivey had that match. Okay.
There is someone listening to this right now yelling at, "Come on, guys!" Sorry, that guy.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
Trying to remember all this stuff off the top of my head. And I, you know, like, I wasn't watching this originally, so this is all, like, stuff I learned later in life. Kind of thing. So, you know, but it's fun.
And I didn't
fun
see
to learn
when it was on.
Well, right. Yeah. You were go ahead.
I was renting these, you know, from the video store, which was inside a gas station, where I lived. So, you know, I'd say whatever wrestling pay-per-view they had that I hadn't seen, you know, I don't know where they were getting these things from, but I'd come in. And so I didn't see this until probably after that had happened. I probably didn't see Starrcade 88 for the first time until, if I had to guess, I'd say probably 90 or 91. So.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I watched it probably the first time, like 97, 98-ish. So, you know, when I really got into wrestling again as a, you know, when I was in college age, as opposed to when I was young. So, a lot of, it's fun to go back and learn. I mean, I think the thing that stood out to me the first time I saw this, and I've seen this match five or six times probably, was just like how passionate that crowd was for this. I mean, this was really their wrestling, and it was really their style of wrestling, and it was really, you know, it was amazing. I was blown away by this match. It was one of the best matches I'd seen at the time, or I felt like it. It's still, I think it's a very, very good match. It's not quite, I wouldn't consider this one of the greatest matches of all time or anything, but at the time, the first time I saw it, I'd seen very little NWA wrestling. So, I was just kind of blown away by it. Like, wow, this is so incredible, you know? And like I said, it still holds up. It's still very good. I recommend anyone watch it, 'cause there's a lot of good things here, but,
Well, the structure of it, as I've mentioned before, I mean, the structure, and I'm, you know, when I watch wrestling, I'm one of the, you know, internet wrestling nerds, although I don't really take it to the internet that much, that I watch things with an eye toward the in-match storytelling, where obviously there's angles and stories going on, but each match should tell a story and not just be a collection of spots or whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
And that's really important to me. And this is what won me over, because as I said earlier, it had Lex Luger in it. So I was ready to not care about it at all. But the structure and the flow of this is something that makes it valuable for repeat viewing because of the way that the whole thing works.
Absolutely.
The story that's told in this match is one that has a very natural feeling progression.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else you want to bring up about the match?
No, that's it. But I do. I mean, the crowd, I'll reiterate what you said. I mean, they were definitely into this, especially that one guy. But, you know, they were chanting Luger's name. They were showing before the match, you know, the signs that were, you know, made by, quote, the crowd or maybe somebody in the Turner Corporation. Who knows? But, you know, a lot of Luger signs and Flair got a big reaction when he came out too. It's interesting, you know, this match was in Virginia and usually, you know, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, Flair's a big deal no matter what, but this crowd, at least what we were shown of the crowd was really behind Luger in this match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely true.
Which I don't understand, guys. Come on.
Well, it was a different time, you know. There was
I know.
Yeah. I mean, this, again, I mean, this was, there was definitely perception, at least in my mind, and I think in a lot of people's minds, you know, at this point and then in the next few years, that, you know, that Flair was, you know, he was close to being done. I mean, he was, you know, he was in about 40 at this point, maybe, you know, around within a few years of 40. You know, there was definitely a sense that, you know, he wasn't going to be the top guy very much longer, that there was going to be a new guy to take it from him. And that never, you know, that didn't really happen. I mean, and gosh, Flair's still wrestling, of course, you know, in 2011. So not very often, but
yeah,
still
happened.
Yeah, it still happens. I mean, he's still, you know, he's a bigger legend than, you know, Luger or Sting, you know, you know, 20 times bigger legend than Luger. So it's weird how you believe something is going to happen and then it just turns out completely, completely differently.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Luger and Sting. Outside of the fact that they teamed together, I mean, I think there's a lot of parallels in their career in my mind, is what I said earlier, where neither of them really ever seemed to find their footing in a match or in an overall character. They never seemed to really have a firm grasp of who they were in the ring or in the way they fit into the angles that were playing out, you know, around what they were doing.
Yeah, I think Sting did a little better than Luger, but I agree. Yeah, they never really, neither guy ever clicked on the level that was just sort of expected. Like, of course they will, you know, just because of maybe of how they were pushed or, you know, or whatever. But, you know, maybe Sting did during the, you know, whole Crow thing. But beyond that, yeah, it just never quite, they both, there was unfilled potential for both, you know. It's just weird how that happens, even though they both had, I mean, I think Sting had legitimately a very good to, you could even maybe argue, a great career, and, you know, Luger had a pretty good run, but you know, they just, because of those expectations, they never really seemed to fulfill them.
I think I agree with that. I do think that, I mean, with Sting, the character was never really defined. I mean, yeah, he had the face paint and he had the, you know, the look. Sting always, by the way, is a perfect reflection of the time. If you look at a picture of Sting from a year, he will look exactly like that year. We mentioned the Great American Bash when the match was stopped for bleeding. When Sting came to the ring, this was 1988. Sting looks like 1988. He's wearing Zubaz and no shirt with a bleach blonde crew cut. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at a picture of Sting from 93, he's got orange and teal face paint and hot pink tights. I mean, he couldn't look more like the 90s if he were a Seinfeld DVD, you know? And so he's always a perfect reflection of the time. But beyond that, his character isn't defined. You know, who is he? What does he do? You know, Ric Flair, you can say, well, he's arrogant and he's the limousine riding, jet flying, you know, whatever. Hulk Hogan is the real American or Hollywood Hulk. Rick Martel is the model. The sheep herders are sheep herders or bushwhackers, depending on, you know. But Sting, what is a Sting? You know, I know he's friends with RoboCop. He sometimes looks like the Crow. Sometimes he looks like the Joker. Sometimes he looks like a Seinfeld DVD. But what is a Sting? What's his finishing move? What's his catchphrase? He doesn't have these things. He's got the Stinger splash, but...
Yeah. Well, yeah, this Deathlock, but...
Well, the Scorpion Deathlock has the best name of any move, but it's, you know, it wasn't a thing like the Figure Four or the Human Torture Rack even.
Oh, really? I don't know if I agree with that. I think the Scorpion was certainly as big as the Torture Rack was. You don't think so?
I don't. And maybe that's my own prejudice against Sting. You know, I'm sure he's a lovely person, but for some reason that move never seemed like a legitimate threat, like, you know, like Arn Anderson's DDT or now I'm trying to think of finishing moves and drawing a blank, but, you know, the Frankensteiner. Okay. Or, you know, any of these things that were these incredibly powerful, menacing things. The Scorpion Deathlock was called the Scorpion Deathlock, so automatically super cool. But for some reason, it just doesn't register in my mind as an entry on the list of, you know, devastating things.
Did you have the same thing about the sharpshooter? Or, I mean, obviously it's the same move, but there's maybe a different perception of it for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Maybe I just don't like submission finishers. I mean, I like the Figure Four, but everything else I named as something I liked isn't. I'm just kind of parsing this out on my own right now for the first time. But yeah, maybe I'm prejudiced against submission finishers. Maybe I like pinfall. Okay. I don't know. I'm thinking about it now. But.
Well, the funny thing is that Flair, of course. I mean, how many matches have you seen him win with the Figure Four?
Right. He almost never does.
Right.
And that thing gets reversed about as often as it gets applied.
Yeah.
You kind of think he'd go for something else. But.
Yeah. I'm not sure I can think of a time other than, you know, probably the Figure Four has been reversed every time I've seen it, except for maybe like five.
And how many times did somebody else apply it to him?
Right. Exactly.
Almost every match. And you didn't see, you know, nobody put the Stunner on Steve Austin.
Yeah, except maybe The Rock, but, you know, like only like in big matches. You know?
But it was a big deal when that happened, when
right.
somebody used that move against him. But everybody was using the Figure Four against Flair. I mean, Luger did it in this match here, and it just happened all the time. So maybe his finisher wasn't necessarily the Figure Four. His finisher was just being the dirtiest player in the game.
Yeah.
You know, and that was not just his finisher, but that was his entire move set.
Sure.
So there's a topic for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was the Figure Four actually his finisher?
Well, I mean, how many matches did it finish? What percentage of matches did the Figure Four finish for Ric Flair? Probably, I mean, certainly less than 10%, probably.
I'd like to know, yeah, how many times the opponent actually submitted to that.
Yeah. I mean, it probably happened a lot more in like the 70s and early 80s, but.
Yeah, maybe Rufus Jones submitted to it.
I probably did, yeah. You know, maybe Bruce Reed or, you know, who knows? I don't know. But, yeah, interesting stuff. Anyway, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about your Tumblr or anything else you want to plug?
I'm on the Twitter. It's Atomic_Elbow. Named after the special action of all the WCW action figures from the mid-90s, Goldberg with Atomic Elbow action. Remember the underscore, kids, because I don't know if there's another one. And then I'm at professionalwrestling.tumblr.com. Can you believe that wasn't taken?
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I have a stack of Pro Wrestling Illustrateds in my garage, and I just scan those and throw the pictures up. Context-free and very little words, every day. And Atomic Elbow is going to be a print thing. Atomic Elbow fanzine is going to be out, I hope, early 2012. We're going to have interviews with some indie wrestlers from Georgia and the surrounding areas. I've already done an interview with Bob Mould from Husker Du and Ooh. Sugar, who was a writer for WCW for 9 months in 99.
Oh, I'm excited to hear that. Yeah.
That's going to be in there. Weird. It was right after he had played a show, and I had emailed him and I asked him if we were going to do the interview, what time was good for him. And he's like, well, let's do it right now. So I didn't record anything. I tried to scribble some notes down as he was talking, and we wound up talking about wrestling until about 3:45 in the morning. And everybody who worked at the club was real mad because they wanted to go home. Bob Mould was great. It was good to talk to him. So
that's
I'm
awesome.
Going to
yeah.
try to do something with this stuff and get a print version of this thing out. And, the Twitter and the dumb little Tumblr thing will be there. And then if you're in Athens – which I doubt you are, but if you're in Northeast Georgia, once a month we do championship wrestling at Flickr, at the Flickr Theater and Bar. We'll show some old wrestling videos. Maybe one day I will show a WWF event. I don't know. Unless, of course, anybody from the WWF is listening to this, then, of course, I would never violate your copyright. once a month. The next one is November 22nd, the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. You can come down and look at some wrestling. So.
All right. Well, everyone should, of course, check those out if they can. And, of course, you can always check us out at WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com for many podcasts and articles and reviews and so forth.
And can I say one thing really quickly? If anybody listening to this is sleeping or on the fence about the print version of Fair to Flare, guys, get on this. That's a good thing.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, we're, of course, the first and second quarterlies are on sale. The second quarterly just recently went on sale, so definitely check that out as well. If you go to fairtoflare.com/quarterly to learn more about that. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and goodbye.
Thanks.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at FairToFlare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.